Woohoo!
Howdy.
Howdy.
How are you today, Jerry?
Good. How are you today, Will?
I'm good. I just got back from Vegas.
I know. How was it?
It was fun. It was Vegas, you know. I did end up like trying to intentionally take a nap like around 7 or 8 o'clock on Saturday night to get up and then go back out.
Okay.
And then I just like got up and then went back to bed. So,
like, really?
I slept a lot. Yeah.
You didn't?
I
mean,
I did
you
a lot
went
of date
to Vegas
parties,
and you
but,
slept a lot?
Yeah. Well, I did a lot of date parties.
Okay.
I did a lot of day drinking on Saturday, a lot of day drinking on Sunday. And
got
then
it.
I got my sleep Saturday night. So, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can't do that. I just
oh, I
go.
Know you can't.
I don't have any boundaries with time. If I'm on vacation, I don't care about sleep.
Yeah.
Well, today I'm super excited. We have Nick Zaleski on the podcast. We're going to talk to her all about her work, but our main conversation is around a practice called orgasmic meditation. And you'll find out more about what that is. But yeah, it was super interesting. She'll describe it in more detail, but it's basically I'm going to read actually from this
That's
website
great.
Because I think that that
right.
will help.
Better to get it right than to stumble around.
Orgasmic meditation is a unique wellness practice that combines mindfulness with the power of the deeply human, deeply felt experience of orgasm. Om puts you in touch with your body and your sexuality. During the practice, one person strokes another person's clitoris for 15 minutes with no goal other than to feel the sensation. Om is safe, systematic, goalless, and intimate. So, yeah, I think a lot of things came up for me even just listening because I think, like, for my brain, this is very far out of what I was programmed to think was like acceptable ways to, first of all, a type of meditation, but also to engage with other people and your body.
It's interesting. I feel like it sounds like, and I wasn't on this call, so like
yeah.
I'll be interested to listen too. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of the interesting things about this is it's taking the pleasure and sexual side of things, but applying the more meditative side to it, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, I think probably for you, it's like, this is not what I was taught. I was always taught, like, it's procreation and maybe there's some pleasure
right.
side to it too, but it's
right.
sex is sex.
Right. And I think we talk about this actually quite a bit, but that, you know, I've been programmed to believe and think in a more masculine way of sex, which is like a more linear approach to it. There's like a beginning and a final end. And this is goalless and very like female centric. And so, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, yeah, I'm interested to try it, but it feels really scary and vulnerable. I think the biggest thing that comes up for me if I think about trying it is like, it's not even, I don't know, necessarily being naked with people I don't necessarily know that well, but it's enjoying it in public for like 15 minutes. Like something about that feels really personal, which is interesting.
Do you think it's like a control thing?
Yeah, it might be. Yeah, I think there's part of my brain, too, that's like, and we also talk about this in the interview, but like there's something in my brain that's like I'm supposed to only take up a certain amount of space and time, especially when it comes to sex. And then we move on to like the main event. And so if this is the only main event.
Oh, you should definitely try it then. That sounds so interesting. No, it's funny because it sounds like, okay, I'm going to draw a weird analogy here, but it sounds to me like how I play improv. Where it's like, if I know we're in an improv scene and this is the thing that's like, you're like, I love apples. Apples are my favorite thing.
Yeah.
Weird choice, but that's fine.
Right.
And then it's like a whole scene about apples. Next scene I'm coming in, I'll be like, hey, it's so weird. All the apples in the world are gone.
Right.
And it's like, now what are we going to do?
Right.
And so it seems like that would be like, you know, you're like, oh, this is about me. And there's not the thing that I'm always used to
right,
going to
right,
isn't
right.
there anymore. What's
yeah.
it look like if it's not?
Yeah. You know, and I was thinking like, because I don't know, especially as women, we're not taught like, oh, there are safe spaces where you can go and like take off your pants and other people can participate and like touch your body in a way where you give consent. It's very specific. There, you know, it's very communicative. Like, this isn't like a silent thing where nobody knows what's going on. It's very explicit. But we're not taught that, like, that's an okay thing to do if that's what we want, right? Like, not everybody has to participate in this, and you don't have to say yes, and you don't have to do it. But I was thinking in the other ways in which we have contact with our genitals that we, you know, just think is normal or fine, which is like getting a Brazilian or getting, you know,
sure,
laser or something like that, or, you know, even like the gynecologist or something, like, that's, you know, obviously like for our health. But those are just ways that, like, it's like similar, but we've decided that that's societally acceptable, okay, and that this, yeah, because it's a little bit more, it's sexual and it's supposed to be for like a meditative release and practice, that it feels outside of the realm of the norm, whether it is or not, you know? Yeah, interesting. Anyways, she's fascinating. This whole conversation is fascinating, and you guys are gonna love it. I'm feeling yummy head to toe. You see me. Welcome to Finding My Yum. Today's episode, I'm so excited. We have on Nick Zaleski to talk about her journey and also specifically OM practice, which we will talk about what that is. But thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, I'm super excited and grateful to be on.
Yeah. And so you have a bunch of titles after your name. You're doing a myriad of things.
Yeah, so I'm a playwright, I'm a director, a facilitator, and cultural activist rooted primarily in the reproductive justice movement. So I do storytelling work and work in communities primarily around reproductive health rights and justice issues.
And what does that look like when you work in communities? Like, are those workshops? Are they ongoing, I don't know, classes or...
Yeah, sort of all of the above. So I devise original plays, most often about sexual violence prevention and abortion access, actually, so two really light topics. And then I also consult with reproductive health and rights organizations on storytelling strategies. So I help people who are doing legal advocacy work and policy work figure out how to center real people's lived experiences to impact the way that they're, you know, strategically thinking about how they advocate to legislators to make decisions about people's bodies, you know, from the sort of framework of really believing that we should center people's real sort of needs and stories as that advocacy happens.
That's amazing. How did you get involved in that aspect, or is there a particular group that you work with?
I work sort of all over the country, and I work for the Center for Reproductive Rights, for Social Movements and Innovation Lab. I'm the co-chair for the board of the Illinois Caucus for Adolescent Health, which is a statewide reproductive justice organization. So lots of different kinds of movement orgs, which I came to primarily because I had been working in youth development for young women's leadership spaces. And the young women that I was working with when I first came into my early organizing days wanted to create workshops and spaces for other young women to think about their sexuality and their reproductive health questions. So that's what kind of took me to that issue area and to that movement. And alongside that, I had come from a theater background myself, and so was applying theater-based tools in those spaces. And so was, you know, had these kind of early experiences of seeing how theater and performance could really open the door to safer, more accessible, and even pleasurable conversations about our bodies and our health. And that's why I kind of came to that intersection then for sort of the beginning of my career.
That's amazing. Well, I'd love to go back a little bit. Were you always active sort of in the political sphere or within sex and sexuality? Was that something that was present from a young age, or like, did you have an awareness about that as you were younger, or was it something you came into at a later age?
I would say I didn't have a sort of direct political awakening until after undergrad. But I definitely saw how arts-based practices could be used for social change in a kind of peripheral way. So I was a dance teacher in high school. You know, I grew up dancing, and then one of my first kind of proper jobs was teaching little girls how to dance. And definitely in my like early ballet teaching days, saw the ways in which these young women either were coming to the dance class spaces from a kind of framework of like judging each other and feeling uncomfortable in their own bodies, and that kind of like standard, you know, thin body, like militants that you can see in ballet spaces a lot. So they were either coming with that, or, you know, were coming with a real fear of judgment from others. And so the dance spaces that I tried to create then, even in that kind of traditional ballet setting and in the studio that I was working in, I was really interested in thinking about how are we talking about celebrating our bodies and celebrating each other's bodies in their weirdest expressions, not just their most technically excellent ones, right? That the dance class then for those girls and then for me at like 16 became a real site of like discovering pleasure, right? Discovering joy and like sort of exuberance in our bodies. And that also it was then it kind of by surprise became a place where one young woman disclosed that she had an eating disorder, which then sort of triggered a domino effect of other young women talking about their own relationship to eating and their sort of like, you know, what's the opposite of confidence, like insecurities, their body insecurities. So it also became this incredible kind of site of dialogue. So while that didn't like directly politicize me, it did help me to see how dance was the way in to these conversations that were really otherwise like quite difficult to have in an accessible, comfortable, and safe way. So that was kind of the earliest seed. And then I stepped more into my kind of like political identity, I would say, when I first came into a movement organization called Sisters Empowering Sisters, which was that young women's leadership space that I mentioned that was really firmly rooted in reproductive justice work. So I got schooled by a bunch of amazing elders in the movement and sort of learned and went from there.
All of that is incredible. When you were in high school, it sounds like you were pretty illuminated to the fact that there were so many dysfunctional sort of messages and body ideals being thrown at all of us women and men. I think I had an awareness around that for sure, but I wasn't able to really tackle it at that point. Like, it was pretty pervasive and I felt like it was just the norm. So to have that kind of illumination seems pretty striking to me. Did you grow up in a family where there was a lot of discourse around this or something like that, or was it just inherent in your nature?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that, well, definitely my mom was a kind of like no shit broad, you know, like she lives out loud and she's highly and often uncomfortably extroverted. And so I saw her talking about things that would make other people uncomfortable with an ease and a kind of like sense of humor and bravado that I think probably actually when I was 15 made me really like uncomfortable and like, oh, this is so awkward, Mom. But
yeah, of course. Like squirming in your skin. Yeah,
but now I really see what she was doing, what she does do so well, which is just bring light to otherwise kind of like shadowy or uncomfortable topics. And I will say that I also just sort of naturally then and probably now too had a real sort of defiance against authority and just like a kind of baked into my bones had this sense that transgression was always healthy And so I grew up, you know, the 4 years I spent in high school and the 4 years I spent in undergrad, like, exactly framed the Bush administration. And George Bush, as you may or may not know, had implemented abstinence-only sex education, you know, in 2002. And so the sex ed that I got in high school and all of the dominant cultural conversations about sexuality and about pleasure and these conversations about just, you know, being authentic and real about our body's desires and needs, those were highly discouraged by the federal government, by the school that I went to. Right. And so then kind of by the
culture at large. Was your school religious or no?
No, it wasn't religious, but it was a public school that received abstinence-only funding, right? As most were during those years. So, you know, if you graduated at any point in time under the Bush administration, this is the kind of education you were getting unless you went to a non-federally funded school. And so, yeah, I mean, I have so many memories from those classes, from the very, like, powerful and potent metaphors that abstinence-only education uses. But I think that just because I had natural defiance baked into me and was quite sexually active during high school, knew that there was something wrong with that kind of cultural silence and, had a natural inclination to speak back against it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I always felt a defiance as well, but it was so slight and I had subscribed so steadfast to the Disney ideal, I think, of like what relationships look like and what sex looks like. And so, yeah, it's just interesting and amazing to hear that, you know, a kid in high school could have this awareness and be spreading it to other women and already starting that message of body acceptance and awareness and pleasure for yourself as opposed to, you know, for the male gaze or for somebody else.
That's a lovely reflection.
So I'd love to move forward a little bit. So I'd love to talk about this OM practice because it's the first time that I've heard about it and I find it absolutely fascinating. So I'd love to have you describe what it is and how you kind of came in contact with it because it's so fascinating and cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so OM is a meditation practice that is focused primarily around the clitoris as the highest point of potential connection between two people. And so the way that it works is it is a goalless practice that is focused on presence and attention as opposed to getting someone to climax. So it involves one person, which we call the strokee, laying down, and one person, which we call the stroker, sitting beside the person with the clitoris who's laying down at the strokee. And the stroker attends to the strokee's clitoris for 15 uninterrupted minutes. And by attends to, I mean applies light and gentle strokes. And ask for adjustments to keep the strokee in what we call orgasm, which is different in the OM work than the dominant cultural like language sort of names orgasm. So often we think of orgasm as that kind of like masculine in the energetic sense of that word, linear, forward moving. All of the blood comes to one point and then comes to a sort of pinnacle and sort of eruption, and then all sensation falls off immediately, right? Like that's our general understanding of what orgasm can mean.
Right, yeah. It's
climax. And in the OM work, we call that climax, actually. So climax is what we associate with the sort of masculine version of, again, all sensation coming to one point and then dropping off. An orgasm, instead, we associate with a more feminine model of pleasure, and it is winding and surprising. It has peaks and valleys and ebbs and flows, and it is sustainable for however long the person who's experiencing orgasm sort of wants to stay in it. And so in the OM practice, the sort of idea is to stay in orgasm for 15 uninterrupted minutes.
Is there a definition? Is orgasm just like in a pleasurable state then? Or is it just
of like highly elevated sensation, right?
It's okay.
I mean, my shorthand for it is like, it's bliss, Gary. Right?
So, it's a what? Right,
it's bliss.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can imagine it's like, it's about coming, you know, close to the point of climax, but not going over, right? Not okay. saying that I have mm-hmm. to like go to that point and let all sensation fall off, but actually that I can stay with the sensation. And part of what I talk about all the time when I coach on to others and when, you know, I'm supporting new folks and coming into the practice is that it's really difficult in our culture to practice not going over in sensation, right? Especially for those of us who are so starved for climax in our lives, right? Like if we're not getting it that often, because it feels like we're getting anywhere near it, we like want to pull for it so much, right? We want to like feel that highest state of elevated sensation as opposed to being, I can stay in this place of elevation without tipping all the way over. And then for those of us who are creatives or who are wanting to put that really powerful energy to work in any way, I love to say OM in the morning, because you can build up all of that really juicy, yummy electricity and that like state of orgasm. And then truly, like even after the session has ended, the 15 minutes are over, the stroker has left, and the strokee goes on her way or their way, the strokee then can put all of that energy to use. So I often will, like, if I own in the morning, then go right to my writing practice. And I'm still sort of in that state of kind of like delicious afterglow, right? I'm still in my orgasm in some way, and that makes me more creative. It makes me more present to what is available in front of me in terms of like colors, textures, sounds, right? It makes me more sensitive to the world in front of me. And it makes for better writing in the end.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so interesting that you say that we're so quick to climax and we're starved for it in our culture. Also, what comes up for me is especially when I've experienced partner engagement, you know, in sex or any kind of play like that, it almost feels like, at least in my experience, and I think the partners that I've chosen, that it needs to happen quickly. Otherwise, it won't happen. And it won't, like, it's because it's not a priority that it's like this rush to like, okay, well, like, let's get this done because it needs to before, like, you know, we have like penetrative sex or something like that, because that, so because that becomes then the focus and we lose track of anything else that like I'm interested in. And not always the case, but it definitely, like, that's been my sort of viewpoint into sex, is that more like masculine type of, you know,
well, totally
connection to it.
That really resonates for me, and thank you for sharing that, because I think the whole, all of the scripts that we get about how to be sexual with each other, right, in the media and otherwise, right, and even in our friend groups and like communities, all of those scripts are primarily like male climax, you know, masculine climax focus, right? They are about penetrative sex and ejaculation being the end of sex, right?
Yeah, like,
and,
period.
And I'm not even talking just in heterosexual relationships. I mean, all relationships receive this kind of programming, right? Mm-hmm. That there has to be some sense of climax for the sexual act to end. And OM is really about unprogramming a lot of the cultural garbage that we get around our pleasure and our sexuality, and mm-hmm. staying with the feeling without it having to do anything and without it having to be sexual. So that's one of, you know, the things that we really try to kind of hammer home about OM is that it's not sex and it's not foreplay. So the two people who practice it together don't have to have any kind of attraction to one another. They certainly, if they're partners, we encourage having a really separate OM practice from any kind of sexual engagement with one another. And that's because it being a practice that is just focused on feeling pleasure for pleasure's sake and not mm-hmm. having to attach it to romantic attraction or emotional sort of weight and attachment is can be really, really, really incredible, especially again for the, you know, from the strokey side or from the side of the person with the clitoris, like in terms of what mm-hmm. that means for reclaiming my pleasure.
Yeah, there's something about it that's very sterile, right? Like there's like a yoga mat and gloves, and like the whole environment is not catered towards any kind of sexual connection or anything. It is sterile, right?
Yeah, exactly. And all of those sterile elements. So, you know, you were talking about the yoga mat. We build something that we call the nest, which is what the strokey lays down in. So that's a yoga mat with a pillow for her or their head, pillows for both sides of the legs, a washcloth that goes underneath the butt, right? Because you do practice without your pants on because the clitoris is exposed. So we put a washcloth underneath the butt, and then the person who is stroking the clitoris wears a pair of gloves. And we do that for two reasons. One is because it just actually is more hygienic and safe. So that one of the things that might be going through somebody's head as they're like receiving pleasure, receiving strokes, is like, oh my God, has the person washed their hands? Like, you know, did they just eat? Like what? That there are all of these tiny little messages that then distract us from being in our full bliss, right? So we want to remove all of those messages as much as possible. So the gloves go on, one, to get rid of some of those messages, and two, to cue, this is not something we often use during sex. So a lot of people do use gloves for digital sex, right? And that's super cool too. But in a lot of relationships, we don't see rubber gloves very present in the sexual space. And so that can cue, this is a different practice entirely. And as you said, it can kind of up the sterility of the situation. And then it's also what we call, it's one of the many elements that does something called safe porting for the person who's receiving the practice. So, and I shouldn't actually say the person who's receiving the practice because both people are receiving huge benefits from the practice, and we can talk about what both of those are, but the person who's laying down needs cues to feel fully safe to do this kind of weird thing, which sometimes means like inviting a stranger into your home to touch your clitoris, which is literally the thing that we are taught from very young ages not to do. And yet it happens to be one of the safest things in the world in this practice. But all of the stuff like the gloves, the nest, the step-by-step process and the things that the stroker says during it, all of those are meant to cue routine for the person who's receiving, right? They are, so the stroker, whether or not the stroker is a man, a woman, a non-binary person, or person of any gender, they are holding down what we call a masculine presence in that space so that the feminine or the person with the clitoris can be fully expressed, right? So the masculine is holding down, here are all of the things that I'm going to say to make you feel super safe and grounded and supported in this practice so that the feminine can just be in her total wild bliss and her own experience and orgasm. And it's a tenet from Tantra that we practice a lot in that work too, which there are, you know, a lot of connections and overlaps with the Om stuff. But it's like, mm-hmm. what is possible for the feminine in terms of a full expression of its own, like, wildness and bloom and blossom, when the masculine can really hold a strong container. That's what gets expressed in the Om practice.
Is there a training that the stroker, like, I guess either person goes through in order to participate, or is it just a conversation before of, this is our goal, this is what's going to happen, and then an allowance of, like, both people's experience?
Yeah, that's a great question. There is lots of training that's offered on Om in, you know, all over the country. There are some cities that have really strong and vibrant Om communities where there are lots of coaches like me. And those coaches do one-on-one sessions, sometimes do group classes. So we teach group classes in Chicago, and then in LA I do some individual coaching and stuff like that. So there's lots of different ways to do it, but usually no one will Om, and in particular no one will stroke without having gone to some kind of training first. So we do discourage the person who is the strokee or who, you know, has the clitoris to be the one who's, like, teaching the stroker, because that also then can sort of get her into her head a little bit, right? It can get her into her programming about, like, this person having to get it right and all of this,
right,
you know, sort of garbage. So we encourage, like, people to get the training, especially if couples are doing it and couples want to experiment. We encourage the couple to go together to a coach or to a class. That generally people do get trained in advance.
And what does the training look like then?
Lots of different models for that. So the two that I work most regularly with is in the group classes, we start with some breath work from a Kundalini tradition, actually. Mm-hmm. And then we teach to a group of usually in between like 10 and 20 people the basic tenets of Om. So we talk about goallessness, which I mentioned. We talk about climax versus orgasm, right? We talk about the ideas and the sort of pedagogy behind it, and then we'll do a live demo, actually. So we'll have somebody who is an experienced practitioner take her pants off in front of the room and lay down, and someone who's an experienced stroker sit next to her and talk through the process step by step as she's receiving it. So that's like the introduction of genitals into the room, right? And then the introduction of the step-by-step process. So that live demo will happen. And then generally what we do there is we'll break. So we'll say, okay, we're going to take a break now. And anyone who wants to can stay and can ask for an Om. So for the first step of every Om practice is asking for someone to Om, right? So we need to get consent before any kind of, you know, contact with genitals happens. And so people who are in the training then can look to each other and can say, hi, would you like to Om, right? And often these are total strangers to each other. And then we set up a nest for each person, and then each person will have an Om. And then we circle back up. Everybody shares one, what we call a frame, which is a value neutral reflection on something they felt during the practice. So it's not, oh my God, it was like a beautiful butterfly landed on my heart and started fluttering it, right? Mm-hmm. No poetry. Mm-hmm. It's just, I felt a warm buzzing sensation on the left part of my labia. And then the stroker will say something like, I felt my heartbeat in my the tip of my fingertip, right? Mm-hmm. Some value neutral thing, just about a sensation that they were experiencing. And part of the magic of that is noticing, wow, I rarely actually pay enough attention to how I feel, like to the physical, like somatic sensations in my body, that I don't even know like what to call them or how to express that, right? Because we have so little practice with it. So that's how a group training will work. And then individual coaching, which I do, is just works a little bit differently. So either I can, you know, I will work with one person on figuring out what their goals are for the practice and sort of talking them through how to meet those goals. Again, the tenets of the practice itself. And then often will connect them to own communities in their city to get them home.
Amazing. And then you mentioned that both the stroker and the strokee have takeaways and ideas of, you know, what the experience can lead to or open up. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, say one more time.
What kind of going in or the, not the goal, but the type of, you know, kind of experience or awarenesses that can come from taking either role and participating in this practice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the strokey, I'll do that because that's the role. So I'm trained as both, by the way. So I I'm a stroker and a strokey, but I most often am a strokey because that's just total bliss. The benefits for the strokey are, you know, some of that reclaiming our pleasure for ourselves, as I mentioned, not having to attach the experience of orgasm to one person, right, or to the all of the sort of emotional connections of it being located in one person, but just noticing, like, how much pleasure we can hold on to in our own lives and for ourselves. There are people who are strokies experience an increase in, again, sensitivity in all of their sensory sort of experiences. So, you know, can smell more, taste more, see more, right? That the world just kind of comes into technicolor a little bit in this practice.
Right, yeah, it comes alive.
Yeah, it comes alive, right.
Well, because it's almost like you're tapping into, like, life force.
Yes. That is exactly it, right? That, like, we're unlocking all of these channels of electricity in ourselves, and that stuff is really, it, like, wants to flow through us, and we often, you know, it's like when people start exercising for the first time, like, how much stuff can get locked up in our body in ways that we don't even know. And for those of us who aren't regularly just, like, in our orgasm, without it having to mean a bunch of stuff, or without us having to work super hard for it, or without us having to reciprocate, right, which is its own programming, that can be really medicinal to keep that light on, right? To turn that light on.
Yeah, that reciprocity part really resonates with me. There is something, I don't know, exhilarating, or sounds exhilarating, about not feeling obligated to reciprocate or feeling like you're in debt now or owe something.
Totally. It's so deep, Jerry. Yeah, it's really the thing that I would say is the most shocking to women and strokees about this practice, and the thing that often people don't believe me about is that you just lay down, and for 15 minutes you get to be on full receive, and then you sit up, you observe one thing that happened, value neutral, in your body, and then you leave, or they leave, and no, in fact, reciprocity is not allowed. So you don't sit up and then, you know, you could jump right into bed together, or sit up and, you know, offer them a hand job, right?
Right.
Actually enough that your pleasure in that moment and the connection that the stroker experienced through witnessing your pleasure is enough. Like, that's a really, it's a profound experience, right? And to do that over and over and over and over again. So, you know, we say with regularity, and that's how you really feel the benefits. It's not like if you just own once, like, everything, your whole life changes. But if you own with regularity, it's amazing the messages that start to undo, you know, about what we owe people when they give us pleasure. And I'd say this is where, you know, the other, I think, deep benefit of the own practice, in particular for strokees, though also for strokers, is related to trauma release, right?
So yeah, I wanted to touch on that piece.
Yeah, that if the site of trespass is in the sort of general area, right? Like if someone has been harmed in that one, like, most sacred space, that going to that spot to heal is pretty profound, right? And that creating a safe container, so safe that the person who, again, is, you know, sort of receiving the practice knows every single step of how things are going to go down and no transgression will happen, that can be tremendously transformative and rewiring for strokees. And, you know, I'll say that being someone who had survived sexual assault myself, I did a lot of work on my own healing before I met the OM practice. In spiritual spaces, I did a lot of, you know, work trying to heal from sexual trauma in some therapeutic spaces, right, in group spaces, stuff like that. But it really wasn't until I found OM that my body was able to sort of move from, let go of some of the ways in which it was holding on to my trauma.
That's amazing.
That's pretty, I think, profound as one of the benefits of the practice for the strokees. And I think for the strokers, two strokers who've experienced trauma in the sexual space in any way, contributing to that safe container and all of the exquisite communication that OM teaches. So, you know, what it teaches about consent, what it teaches about giving adjustments and gracefully accepting adjustments, right? So when a strokee is laying down, if she's feeling like, oh, they're not quite on the spot, right, they can say, you know, can you try some upstrokes a little bit faster? Can you move down into the left? Come up on top of my clitoris. I'd like some downstrokes now, right? So there are all of these sort of minor adjustments that can be made that both train somebody to know their body really well and then also train the stroker to, like, know what it feels like to get adjustments in that space, which is totally amazing. And then that increases listening, sensitivity, attunement for the strokers, which then, by the way, leads to, like, a better sex life outside of the OM practice.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's incredible. Well, so where can people find OM practitioners or spaces where this is practiced and get involved if they're looking for it, or find you, because you come to LA, right? You're in Chicago and Los Angeles?
Yeah, so I have been splitting time between Chicago and LA for the past 5 years, but I'm actually about to move to San Francisco. So I will be shifting locations a little bit. And yeah, the short answer is that there's online spaces that are good to learn about. So One Taste is an organization that has been training and teaching on the work for the past few years, and people have lots of different perspectives on them as a company. I did their coaching program and had quite a positive experience with their coaching program. But totally, I get some of the critique on them as well. But they have a lot of really awesome materials available for free online. So again, that company is One Taste, and then
it's called One what?
One Taste. Taste the rainbow.
Got it.
Perfect. Yeah, and they're awesome. And then, yeah, again, there are coaches in lots of cities that are connected through, like, a sort of coaching hub that One Taste does, and then also lots of word of mouth coaching situations. So I, as well as the person who I teach with in Chicago, who's a Kundalini teacher named Guna Shan, we both teach it really specifically from a trauma lens, which is very different from how a lot of One Taste coaches train in it. They come more from a desire perspective. Neither is good nor bad, but the sort of trauma approach, I think, keeps the practice really, really pristine and really focused on the strokey, actually. And so, yeah, people, of course, can find coaches through each city's Facebook group. So every major city has a like an own Facebook sort of channel. And so can find out about those through One Taste, through me. Yeah, there are usually like gatekeepers in each city who can say like, oh, here's the Facebook channel. Here's how you can get Omen. But usually here's the shorter answer. It's like finding a coach to do 1 to 3 sessions just to start is a really, really great way to get going. And then they can usually unlock access to like, here's where the community is. Here's how you ask for an Omen. Here's who you should connect with and so on.
Got it. And then how do people find you if they would like to?
Yeah, certainly people can find me on Instagram at Nicklynz, Niklynz. And then my website is just my first and last name.com. So it's nickzaleski.com.
Awesome. And we will put that in the show notes. I've thoroughly enjoyed this. Thank you so much for taking time to talk about this and share your experience and share this practice. It's definitely like something I've never heard of. So it's so cool that, I don't know, that this is even like available and that we're able to explore pleasure in these ways that haven't, I don't think, you know, at least publicized, been available previously from what I can understand.
Yeah, right on. Yeah. Thanks so much, Jerry, for the conversation, too. Yeah. It's really nice to reflect with you and talk about this practice, which I love so much.
Yay! Yay! Well, thank you!
Woo-hoo. Yeah. Enjoy the rest of your night.
Woo! Woo, 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 woo. How great was that?
I'm imagining it was very great.
Oh, don't give it away that you haven't listened yet.
Well, you know... There, curtain's been pulled back, everybody.
Oh, no. Will was too busy sleeping in Vegas.
I was. Hey, it was nice.
Anyways, Nick is amazing. Thank you for joining us. Go and try it out. I think I'm going to go try it. So I will report when I do that. But yeah. So many interesting and awesome things out there that I never knew. And it's just because of this podcast that I now am aware.
If you know of any other interesting things or amazing things, reach out to us.
Yes. Come be a guest or send us other guests to our email.
At findingmyyum@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Follow us on social at Finding My Yum Podcast on Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah. Send us messages. Also, subscribe, rate. Rate us 5 stars on wherever you listen to podcasts.
Share with a friend.
Share with 5 friends.
Yeah.
Share with 10 friends.
Or only one if that's how you feel.
Or, yes.
Or 100.
Or 100. Let's keep going. Stay yummy.